All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, and happy 4th of July. Let's celebrate what remaining independence we have for this Independence Day. So long as, I don't know, we can leave our houses perhaps, but I don't think we're going to be able to, unfortunately. But this is episode 188 of the show. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/188. This is the show where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian and anarcho-capitalist perspective. And we're going to have a special guest join us for the last night's portion of the show, talking about The Patriot tonight. But before we introduce him, let's go down to Robert and check in with you, see how things are going where you're sitting. You're not wearing a mask. Are you now breaking the law? It is now a misdemeanor in this state to show your face, apparently.
Yeah, what is it, like a $1,000 fine and like time misdemeanor? What is it? I don't know. You can actually go to jail. I don't think anybody's actually going to enforce it. I mean, there's been some good pushback from the sheriffs and the cops to some extent. At least they have some middling understanding of liberty, which is nice.
Yeah, I think it's 90 days in jail. And a substantial fine. Now, you're right. I don't think that they're going to be able to enforce it. And I don't think that they've done any of this yet, as it only just went into effect. However, comma, I will say that if it's intended for your safety, the efficacy of masks must be a factor. And if they say they're going to follow the science, maybe they actually should. And further, if they're going to say it's for your safety, why would they threaten you with violence in 90 days in a cage? And if you resist, they'll kill you. For your safety. Seems like a pretty bizarre backwards situation.
Well, if they're going to enforce violence on you, if you're going to resist, then they essentially could put a knee on your neck. And I don't think anybody would respond positively to that. I think they are really cracking down on the businesses, though. Apparently, there's more and more businesses that are just saying you have to wear a mask in here or else you can't be in here. I know Costco is one, but more and more companies are jumping on the bandwagon, and it seems to be normalizing this behavior to the point where you're just going to be, yep, carrying around this thing in my back pocket, put it on when I walk through these doors, go through the rituals of safety, this safety theater that we all seem to be so obsessed with recently, and go about our lives, hopefully, just hoping that the axe doesn't fall on our heads. But I won't be wearing one. I know we're supposed to, as a restaurant, we're supposed to be either forcing it on our customers when they enter. But when they actually stop and eat, they can take it off. Just so nice of our overlords to allow us to actually not wear one while we're eating, because that would be kind of weird. But no, we're not due to this and a few other factors, other like the phase two rules, we are not opening up our dining room for customers. We're still remaining a takeout only. So it's still having a big impact on business.
Well, that is quite unfortunate. And it's a real strange situation where we've moved from phase one to 1.5 and now to two, yet they're going backwards as far as like the amount of restrictions they're imposing upon everybody. And it seems to me that the founding fathers, as depicted in the film The Patriot that we're going to be talking about tonight, had a far lower tolerance for what impositions they were going to allow to be permitted upon them. It seems like that modern day society is more than willing to accept all of these incursions on their liberty. And it's quite unfortunate.
Indeed, sir. No, what was it? A 3% tax? Was it on coffee or tea or something like that? I mean, I forget exactly what it was, but it was very, very minor stuff compared to the impositions on liberty we suffer today, and just seemed to, the Karens of the world seem to like yell and scream and harp at us to go along with it and just wear the mask so that we can all get back to work and go about our lives, as if that is what's preventing us from going back. It's not the government enforcing all these ridiculous rules and regulations. it's the people who refuse to wear masks were the problem.
Right. And I don't even think that they want things to be open yet either. They want masks, but also lockdowns and also a vaccine, and nothing can be open until there is such a thing. But it's a really bizarre clown world situation. And I think we should maybe shift into the Last Nerds Person Show, because we've been going a little long on the actual anarchy portion here. And we'll introduce our guest right after this. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. You can also find this at lastnighters.com/131 as we talk about the movie The Patriot. We're going to celebrate what remaining independence we still have, reviewing The Patriot, which is a Mel Gibson movie, with Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast, which is another movie review show. So it's going to be a crossover episode. It's going to be fireworks, barbecue, freedom, America, fuck yeah. Welcome to the show, Bobby. How are you doing, my friend? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is, I can tell this is going to be a lot of fun already. Did you say barbecue?
Well, yeah, I mean, not like virtually. You can't taste my meat or anything like that. But there will be barbecues to be had, especially during this weekend. It's a holiday weekend. Everyone's going to be celebrating their freedom while wearing masks, locked in their homes. So it's all about that freedom that, you know, founding fathers fought for so valiantly, as depicted in this fictional film based on somewhat historical events.
Well, and all
I
the
have
troops,
a mask
right?
of the Betsy Ross flag ready to go.
Oh, all perfect. The troops have been fighting for our freedom too. They must be pissed.
Super pissed. So, Bobby, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself to our audience and where they can find your show, and maybe a little bit about what your show is about, other than, you know, just my random movie review show thing.
It was an apt description, but I got kind of a formal background in broadcasting and film. I currently host the Not For Everyone podcast. The way I describe it is it's kind of two cynical man children, more or less exploring their flawed friendship through the lens of obscure cult and horror movies. It's loud, it's offensive, it's lowbrow mostly, highly politically incorrect. And we kind of consider the name Not For Everyone podcast to be the trigger warning in and of itself. In addition to that, I'm a fairly regular contributor at fearforever.com, which is a indie horror movie review website. And kind of how I got synced up with you guys, I'm occasionally will guest host on Death to Tyrants, which is a podcast hosted by Buck Johnson, who's a hardcore ANCAP, secessionist, Mises, Rothbard, Hoppe type guy. It's a good show, solid guest, both in and out of the libertarian world, and I appreciate it because it's not. I got to plug Buck real quick. Hold on. I appreciate it because it's not a lot of party politics and inside baseball chit chat. It's more philosophy and current events and things of that nature. So,
right, yeah, and I have listened to Death to Tyrants, his podcast, a couple of times, especially the appearances with Jeff Deist, and they were quite good. Buck does a great job, and I understand that you are also occasionally co-host with him. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, that's why I mentioned that.
Well, see, I was sitting here thinking about what I was going to say rather than
right
listen
on, right
to
on.
You.
Right on. No, it happens.
one of my friends, Raylene, is writing to us saying that she loves the show as we're recording the show right now. So thank you, Raylene Lightheart of the Johnny Rocket Blast Off with Johnny Rocket and Raylene Lightheart, also found on Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Check it out at
launchpadmedia.com.
So we had a really good pre-show with you, Bobby, and that is available for Patreon supporters, and they can find that at lastnighters.com/Patreon. There are people watching right now who can watch the sausage getting made, so head on over to lastnighters.com/Patreon. Chase is our most recent patron, and he is now in the live stream group. I just added him today, and he gave some very glowing comments as well. So apparently we're doing something right. People who encounter us, at least one person likes it. So good job us, Robert. All right.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Make it two.
All right. So how we start this off, generally speaking, is we head on over to the old Google and get the description that they've got posted thusly. And I just got to find out where I put that because all my windows have moved around. That's not good. This is really great content, by the way. Super good stuff. Oh, there it is. There it is. I found it. All right. Here we go. Google description. The Patriot came out in the year 2000, rated R. It's a war slash action film in 2 hours and 55 minutes. We've been doing long ones lately, Robert. 7.2 on that IMDb, 61% Rotten Tomatoes, and 63% Metacritic. However, 91% of Google users gave it the old comedy-style thumbs up. The description reads, a widowed farmer with a brave but brutal military past decides not to join up when the British arrive in 1776. However, when his son enlists and is later captured by the enemy, the former soldier must abandon his newfound pacifist principles in order to rescue his oldest child and forms a regiment of Carolina Patriots, whose guerrilla tactics prove pivotal to the U.S. war effort. This came out June 27th, the year 2000. It sounds very futuristic, even though it's a past movie. The director is, of course, the Independence Day director of Roland Emmerich, music composed by John Williams, and a budget of $110 million, starring, of course, Mel Gibson and Heath Ledger, among others. Robert, I will go to you for your opening information.
Well, this is my reaction to what you said. Yeah, sure, Daniel. So we got Mel Gibson back on the silver screen fighting the Redcoats, the British, which is, he's good at it. So why not? You know, John Williams, I did notice the music in this film. It was a bit standout. There are some serious moments where, you know, they're tugging on your heartstrings and they did a pretty good job. It's interesting to see this era of warfare for me. This is the time when you've got these highly regimented, stand and fight kind of movements by armies, but you've got this Continental Army that is fairly ragtag. You got a bunch of like these colonial militiamen. And then you've got, of course, the Continental Army led by guys like Washington and those people. But a lot of the time the colonialists were fighting on the back foot and you were outnumbered and you knew the terrain better. So you were using these guerrilla style hit and run tactics, and it was just a very effective means when you're fighting a larger, stronger force to cut off the supply lines, to interrupt communications, to do these little hit and run maneuvers where you can attack and then escape through the swamp or whatever. You can really harry their forces to the point where they're really weakened when it comes down to actually getting into these big battles. So you're not necessarily going to knock them out with all these little guerrilla style tactics, but you are going to weaken them and destroy their morale for the big blows that eventually do come. So yeah, it's an interesting time in history. You know, I think there's a lot of interesting quotes that I took that I just wrote down verbatim from the initial meeting when Mel Gibson goes to, I don't know, was it Fredericksburg or whatever it was? And they're kind of debating what to do. And there's just, and I just wrote all kinds of stuff down. So that's the main meat that I want to really get into is that part there. But yeah, right. good film, a little bit on the long side, but you know, it's not too bad.
Well, I like that you like to get into the meat and the long as well. And just a little bit of feedback, the nature of war at the time seemed to be more of a respectable gentleman's profession as dictated by the betters or the elite class, sending the pawns and the peons out into these regimented lines to be shot and drop and then return a volley of fire. And it just seems like so ridiculous to see it as shown in the movie. Like, I can't believe that was actually how they did warfare. They like just willingly lined up to be shot and then returned a volley of fire. Now, I understand the whole reload situation was a little bit more difficult because you had to put powder and a shell in. And then, you know, it took a lot of time. And so they would do this sort of coordinated firing. But man, just imagine you're in that first row and you're marching. I mean, you know, pretty good probability you're going to get the vid. So, you know, pretty crazy stuff. But anyway, Bobby, do you have any reaction at this point to anything Robert said or the Google information? I took issue with the first part of the Google description where they said that when the British arrived in 1776, they were kind of there, right? So it seems a little odd choice of words there.
Right. And I will, I'll preface by saying that I'm at best an armchair history buff and haven't taken a colonial history class since about 2003. Moving forward, any kind of fun facts are completely either researched or possibly made up. If I have two words to describe this film without pejoratives, if we're giving this the benefit of the doubt, it's competent and it's effective, right? It looks good. You have some pretty trite dialogue, as Robert was kind of alluding to earlier. If I didn't misinterpret that, you have performances by like kind of top stars of the day. You have Mel Gibson, Heath Ledger, the guy that played Odo from Star Trek, Deep Space Nine. Always a treat to see that guy. But I guess what I'm getting at is it successfully does what it's trying to do. It pulls at your patriotic heartstrings. It fires up your loins of freedom. But it is obviously a big budget war epic targeted for kind of your middle America popcorn general public. That said, it's a blue ox and a stack of flapjacks away from being a folktale. It's comic book, it's Americana junk food. And I have more to say, but I feel like I've been stealing the limelight. So that's my initial thoughts on that.
No, steal away. We're here to lift you up and have your voice be heard. But yeah, I do agree with your sentiment that it does seem to have a whole heck of a lot of cartoonish kind of scenes and just symbology, especially at the end where he literally takes the flag and stabs the horse with it.
And I love lowbrow schlock like that. Like that didn't, I was not to jump to the end already, but I stood up and cheered because I was like, I hadn't seen this since the year 2000. And I was like, oh my God, is he going to stab someone with a flag? Like, and then he did, he would stab the horse, which it kind of would have been cooler, honestly, if he stabbed the main dude. But that scene alone is kind of a microcosm of this entire film, and that it's the mythology of the American patriot, right? It might as well be someone like Davy Crockett, where they toe that line between a real person and someone that's more of a legend, or like a, what's that guy's name? Johnny Tremaine, stuff like that. But he was based on a real guy who I did a report on in fourth grade, Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, and a couple other guys. But that was one of the main inspirations of Mel Gibson's character.
Oh, nice. Okay. Very good. Well, Robert, I want to get you in on this because it looks like you got a few things to say there.
Well, we can talk about Mel Gibson's character. He starts off as this reluctant hero type, and we learn throughout the film because he committed some atrocities at a battle where he is wildly renowned as this hero because of what the people that he slaughtered, you know, done previously to, like, women and children. And so he goes to this convention where they are going to vote on South Carolina, what they're going to do, where they're going to join, was it Massachusetts at the time, to fight? Because at this time, the Continental Congress hadn't declared independence yet. And they're still deciding if they're going to join the effort with Massachusetts. And he goes there and he has all this like philosophy and he has these good arguments. And then he just kind of changes his mind. And it seems to be because of family, not necessarily because he's changed his mind on his philosophy. So here's one quote. He says in rebuttal to one guy who's like, yeah, we need to go fight these British. He goes, why should I trade one tyrant 3,000 miles away for 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away? An elected legislature can trample a man's rights as easily as a king can. And he's absolutely right. And nothing in the film changes his view on that, nor I don't think could it. But somehow he joins the revolution and he joins back up with the army. And he's all gung ho, and maybe it's more of a revenge story at this point because the evil colonel guy murdered his son. But it seems like an incomplete arc, right? To me, it does, because he goes from being this kind of anarchist character who says, no, government's terrible. They can trample your rights. Both of them can, to joining into this battle to instill these 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away. I mean, it seems like he makes this shift and there's no real reason why other than, well, I need to kill this guy that killed my son. And the best way I can do that, I guess, is to join this war effort. I don't know. It seemed kind of convenient for me.
And I noticed that too. It's like his arc happened within like the first 20 minutes of the movie, within act one. I mean, there were some, you know, ebbs and flows to his character throughout the movie, but you're right. He's your, you know, seasoned war hero, you know, resisting coming out of retirement. He's seen the horrors of war. He has a family now. He's a bit hesitant to get involved. He recognizes, like you said in that quote about the you know, elected legislator can trample a man's rights as easily as a king can. But I agree with everything you just said, Robert. However, the breaking point, for lack of a better phrase, is when shit got real, was when you had homeboy English, what's his name, Tavington, murder his younger son later on, and take his older son off to the gallows, or at least try to. So it was one of those things where he's trying to resist getting involved. He's seen all this before. He just wants to live his life. He doesn't want to expose his family to these atrocities. Yet push comes to shove, like you said, when you mess with a man's family, which is what he was trying to protect all along in the first place, that's when he joins up, I guess.
Yeah, when they mess with his blood and soil, he fights back, and eventually his son enlists. And well, his son had already enlisted, but yeah, he sees how terrible the leadership is, and then he's like, okay, I guess I got to help these losers out.
I think you're right there.
I wouldn't go so far as to say this is like he's not really a one-dimensional character, but he is like kind of your standard melodrama archetype, right? Especially for like a wartime, you know, period piece that's aimed at the general public, right? Like I said, you got your, and there's more of these in this movie too. You got your seasoned veteran with a secret guilt he's dealing with, his own demons and whatnot. And then you have like his old stoic war buddy. And then you have like the eager young Luke Skywalker type, which is his son. And then you have like a man of God and a slave and a foreigner. And then like you might as well had a guy named Tex in this movie. Cause it checks all those boxes. And I'm not saying that, and to its credit, it's not trying to shoehorn any of these like characters we already really know about from this time in real historical context. It's contained in its own world. Like I was waiting for a montage where I saw like an out of focus, Paul Revere riding through Boston, or like, you know, like Washington crossing the Delaware at the end or something like that. But that, to its credit, that never happens. However, because this movie's effective and because it's trying to do what it does successfully, it does check all those boxes of, again, your gang of roustabouts, your Benedict Arnold character, no pun intended. And then your melodramatic antagonist that, isn't even human. He might as well have had like a curly mustache and a top hat. I agree with Robert in that his arc is very, I guess, premature.
See, I'm going to disagree wholeheartedly, because not only does he have his son gets murdered by the guy, his other son being brought to the gallows against the traditions of war, the proper process, because he's just a courier and by the rules of engagement or whatever in place at the time, those are not being honored. Then they destroy his home. So not only do they kill two of his sons or attempt to kill the second one, they destroy his entire livelihood. And that changes the game, because this is a king tyrant from 3,000 miles away who sends this Tavendish guy to go and murder people and destroy his property, his life, that he probably is willing to now make that trade to have 3,000 local tyrants who would not be able to amass such power, at least back in that time. I think now, today, with the 3,000 little petty tyrants around the country right now locking things down, I'd almost trade it back for a tyrant 3,000 miles away. What is it Alex Jones used to say, like 1776 will rise again, where you talk about like how much tyranny was actually in place at that time versus how much tyranny is there now. Like, what was intended to be the smallest, most restrained government ever has grown into the biggest, most powerful, most expansive government ever, all in the span of a few hundred years. And so it's almost like, well, what would you trade it back for the amount of, you know, incursion that they had at that time versus what we've seen it grow into today, where it's, you know, the United States projects its violence across the world. So, you know, it's a pretty big shift. But that's where I think he originally has that philosophical argument of why would I exchange one tyrant for many tyrants who are even closer. I think it's once that one tyrant who's far enough away demonstrates just how lethal and how violent he's willing to be, that he's now willing to make that trade.
Yeah, I don't know, Daniel. I think the scene where he decides to join the army is that scene where he's in his sister-in-law's house and Heath Ledger's standing at the window and they're watching this battle play out before them. And Mel Gibson's like, oh, look at these guys. This battle was over before it started. They're terrible. They don't know what they're doing. And he joined up right away. But yeah, I mean, you could be somewhat right. I mean, they did burn his house down. He didn't have a place to stay, but other than his sister-in-law's house.
I think that part kind of like was an exposition to like add to his, you know, it was like the straw that broke the camel, or one of the many straws that broke the camel's back after they murdered his son and burned his house. It didn't help that the Continental Army or the militia or whatever it was not particularly talented when he was watching from a window. And I agree with both of you as well.
Oh man,
tough act. Fence sitter over here.
Yeah, I'm a middle bitch that one.
Yeah, okay, but, so Daniel, I got okay. some more. I got some more quotes from that scene. Okay,
all right, we're gonna do quotes. It's quote night.
So after he says that an elected legislature can trample a man's rights as easily as a king can, they go, so what's the answer, Mel Gibson, you super smart guy? And Mel Gibson goes, we plead before the king to avoid a war. And he goes, well, we've tried doing that. They're super dedicated to this. And he's like, well, we try again and we try again and we try again. We just keep asking and asking and asking. And I don't know how effective of a tactic that is, to just ask you to please stop oppressing me, evil tyrant guy. I mean, begging your masters kind of assumes that you recognize and acknowledge that they are your masters. It doesn't seem to be the most effective tactic. It seems to be more like, please, sir, would you be nice and only beat me on Tuesdays? It's like, no, I'll beat you whenever I want.
Yeah, so that's the Walter Block argument, where Batty A promises to beat you less than Batty B, so you're going to vote for Batty A. That kind of argument. But you're right. With a bully, sometimes you just need to punch him in the mouth.
Yeah, yeah. When someone's bullying you, you grab some weapons and you say, draw a line in the sand.
Let's just say that Colonel Tavington violated the NAP.
Which one was Quite Colonel well. Tavington again? Is he the evil? No,
the main bad guy.
Super evil dude.
The guy that burned his house down and murdered his family.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I think that's probably a NAP violation there.
Yeah.
I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, a little libertarian street justice was called for. And when he was watching the engagement where he said it was over before it started, that was the Continental Army, because Mel Gibson was who mustered up a militia. And he was following his son, who decided to go back after recovering from his wound, and he couldn't stop him. So then he was like, well, right, now I'm going to go, you know, try to protect my son or talk him out of it or whatever. And then he saw what he saw and he's like, they're hopeless. So they're going to need, you know, somebody to tell him to do this a little differently.
Okay. I got more quotes. Here's the next quote, Daniel. If your principal, this is the general of the Continental Army guy. I don't know his name, but we all recognize this guy in movies before.
Chris Cooper.
That's the guy. If your principle dictates independence, then war is the only way. And I don't know about that. I think Gandhi and Martin Luther King, through peaceful noncompliance, kind of demonstrated that you can get societal change, although I don't know if you can actually get independence through doing that. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
You care to direct that to anyone in particular?
Oh, whoever's got most thoughts, whose brain is really buzzing? Daniel, well, your brain looks buzzing.
I'll just say that those two people did use peaceful means, but it in present day, that still wasn't good enough, apparently, because both of those people have since been labeled as bad or their advice ignored. So in Gandhi's case, he has a statue up and they want to tear that down because apparently he was racist in some way. I don't know enough about it. And then with Martin Luther King, where he would say, you know, he had a dream that people would be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin, seems to have been totally ignored these days, as we were talking about in the pre-show. How much change did they truly affect? And well, I agree that it's not always war that's going to be the answer. For instance, in the War of Northern Aggression, the South simply wanted to secede and form their own union, their own nation. And certainly some of it was to preserve the perverse institutions of slavery. Some of them said that in their separation arguments, but others did not. They had many other grievances as well. And there's a whole history about this. And most people want to boil it down to just slavery bad, and that's it. But there's a lot more nuance to it. But it was war that was there to try to keep them from seceding. So in that instance, they were peacefully trying to leave, and then war was brought upon them. So
right. You're about to be removed from YouTube in like 5 minutes.
That's true.
So is the general right then? Is war the only way to establish independence from a group of violent thugs that can't let you leave?
Not sure if I can think of another one that really hadn't gone that way.
I mean, historically, it's always been war. I mean, maybe with technology, we can do something else, but I don't know, outside of jetpacks to Mars or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, given the nonviolent approach, what would that even look like in this scenario?
Yeah, I think it's just non-compliance, right? I mean, it would be right. Just not paying taxes and declaring that you're untaxable and, I don't know, ungovernable.
But if the institution that you're resisting is inherently violent, and
which it
they
is.
Have a history of being violent, as we see in the 2000 movie The Patriot, starring Mel Gibson.
I've heard of that one.
What other choice do you have at that point? And I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. It could be rhetorical. You guys could have an answer to it. I don't know.
Well, not only that, but if you're isolated and just wanting to be left alone, like most people of the independent streak, then it's easy to pick you off one by one. You almost need to amass in some sense, or collectively. And I don't mean collectively like everyone's under the control of the group, but I mean, just en masse, do something that is non-compliant, so much so that there's too much for them to deal with.
Right. And I think you also need to get the messaging correctly. I don't know how you get the state-run media to be on your side, but if you can get sympathy from a wide swath of the population to your cause, like if there was a group of liberty-minded, I mean, they might be depicted as Nazis, although their heads might explode. If it was a bunch of black people who are liberty-minded and wanted to have a Gulch situation, the media's head would probably explode. But, you know, if they could have, you know, they could talk about their oppression and whatever, I think that they could actually successfully, you know, secede and get popular support behind it. Because they could talk about the systemic racism and, you know, all the cultural oppression and all that, whatever. You know what I mean? And then they'd have the oppression points so that if anybody did come and attack them, military, National Guard, cops, anybody, they could easily play the victim way better than a group of like liberty-minded black and yellow gold people. You know what I mean?
Or Mel Gibson with the ponytail.
Yeah, that ponytail.
They already hate him.
Not doing him any favors.
No, the ponytail doesn't do any favors.
Yeah, so I think maybe there's some legs to that, Robert. Maybe if they did the Chaz thing, but on a larger scale, and selected where they wanted and counted that as, quote-unquote, the reparations, like, hey, give us this landmass as our own country.
Or even buy it legitimately, and then just say, hey, we're not going to pay taxes, we're not going to be beholden to the state, we're going to do our own thing. Kind of like the Amish do, although I don't know if they pay taxes, I don't know.
And there's even dialogue from, I guess, Cornwallis, in this movie, who is like the main British army general dude, who's more or less discouraging Tavington from enacting such, you know, immense
brutal
violence on these people, because he acknowledges that, like, one, these are our brethren, but two, like, we want to keep engaging in commerce with these people. So there might be an angle there in this context of, like, look, we know you don't want to fight, despite the fact that this guy that you sent to our village and to murder us would say otherwise. But if you're truly interested in commerce, we need to come to a compromise here where you give us our independence and then we don't collectively stop doing business with you.
Right. And of course, he thought that they were still going to win, so they would still be British colonies and they would still want to have them for trade for cotton, tobacco, etc. Yeah, I don't think he had it in his mind that they were even at a risk of losing. I think it was a pretty lopsided event, historically speaking.
Well, especially since the British had an incredible win rate up to that point in that modern time. I mean, in not necessarily in terms of winning against the French or other European powers, but as for their colonies, they were like batting 1,000.
Yeah, and they were just thinking they were just quelling a rebellion, and that once that's kind of tamped down, then things would kind of go back to normal. And so if you brutalize them, what is it? It's that coin situation in Afghanistan where, like, you kill one terrorist and you create 10 more.
Indeed. Yeah. You burn one guy's house down and yeah, he's going to get pissed off about it and kill his kids. Yeah.
Right. So that's what happened to Mel Gibson and all these guys in the movie. You know, that was what emboldened them to finally take up arms and actively resist
and become terrorists in the eyes of the crown.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a freedom fighter versus terrorist. You know, it's a matter of perspective. I'll let you in, Bobby.
I was going to say, like, as you see in that initial scene where they're all discussing whether or not they're going to go to war, like, Mel Gibson's character, like you said earlier, like, is not interested. And it's too late at that point. It's too late for negotiations. Bunker Hill had already happened, or, you know, it's already gotten escalated to the point of violence. So it's that ratchet effect that once the violence starts, it's probably, I'm not going to say easier, but more it's probably easier to convince people to fight back physically than try to negotiate their way into independence or nonviolent resistance or whatever.
Okay, last quote from that scene, and then we can move on. All right, so Gibson is kind of explaining why he's against fighting, even though he's this war hero. And I forget who he tells this to, but he says, "I'm a parent. I haven't got the luxury of principles." So, Daniel, as a parent, how have you violated your principles?
Oh, well, I do see the difficulty with this, because when you are responsible for providing for a family, for children, it does sort of limit what you're willing to do or risk. It changes the equation for what you're willing to do on a matter of principle. So certain things you kind of just have to let go because it's not worth the risk, especially for, you know, who's depending on you. So I think that's one part of it. And then more specific to your question, you know, what have I done that is against my principles? Well, I'd say parenting in and of itself sort of leads one down a path of dealing with unreasonable little tyrants who are ages 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, who are not open to reason. And so occasionally you need to take a certain escalation path to isolate them from you or from their sibling from causing further harm. And so those are some things that are somewhat against principle, but I think some necessary things to prevent further harm.
Are you equating your children to George III and Queen Elizabeth? Is that what's happening here, Daniel?
I'm saying that at their age, where everything up to that point has been about them being served, things magically appearing to them if they cry, whine, bitch, moan, complain.
So they're socialists, yeah.
Basically, yes.
They're Chazians.
Yeah, and so it's somewhat of a tyrannical thing because I am duty-bound to provide that to them. And so it does get into this situation where you can view them as demanding things and me not having a choice, thus tyranny. Bobby, you got kids, right?
I do not. That's why I wanted to pick your brain for a moment some more. So I was going to ask whatever context you want to apply this to, when you have kids, and I may be asking the wrong person, but when you have some sort of paternal or maternal instinct to protect your children, do you think that in general people are more susceptible to submitting to tyrants? Meaning when the marching orders come down from the state or whatever institution for your safety, you'd rather just play ball than try to resist because you have children to protect.
Yes, absolutely. And there are actually things that are related to children that you're required to do, even though they're bullshit things. But rather, you kind of have to pick your battles, right? Like, do I put up with this inconvenience or do I fight it and risk further inconveniences?
Sure.
Yeah, and I noticed that.
Go ahead.
Well, I noticed.
I think that sums up perfectly kind of maybe if we want to apply some sort of internal struggle or juxtaposition with this character of Mel Gibson, is he's doing a cost-benefit analysis. He's literally picking his battles, and it got to the point where he had to pick an actual battle for various reasons, despite the fact that, originally he didn't want to get involved because of his family and because he's experienced the horrors of war and because he's over that part of his life, and B, he still feels obligated to protect them at the same time. That's all I was going to say.
Right. Plus, he's also highly skilled at it. I mean, this is his thing. I mean, he's called into this and he has the skills and ability to do it. So it makes it easier for him, I think.
All right.
Robert, okay, I cut you off for the last time.
Well, I was just going to rag on. I was going to kind of talk about Daniel because he recently tweeted out, or I don't know, Facebook posted or some kind of social media thingamajigger where he went to a Costco, and I know he's not a fan of the Costco CEO who recently did a press junket with our overlord Jay Inslee here in Wa State. And but you went along with the tyranny under the guise that you valued the goods and the prices being offered higher than your own personal statement of going along with this or not. Is that fair?
I'd love to give you a clarification on this. All right. So just for the folks at home, Costco requires face masks in all of their facilities, and they have done so for a good couple of months now. Now, I have not been into a Costco since February to purchase any goods. I have purchased online. I am also an executive member. And thusly, I get a rebate certificate once a year. And rather than spend it online, I oftentimes choose to go and redeem it for fiat notes, Federal Reserve notes. And so I was doing that this time as well. And it was the first time I had a chance since receiving said certificate to go in, because we were passing through on the way to exercise a little bit of freedom by going to a park to visit my mother before I went to the dentist, not sure which thing I was dreading more. So I went into Costco to get cashola. And thus, I wore a rainbow tiger-striped Tiger King mask in order to do so.
And was that, did you feel like that was a violation of your principles? Or you were like, hey, this is private property. They've got their rules. I'll follow their rules.
Yes, I thought this is private property, though it's stupid and pointless and uncomfortable and a bit demeaning. But I want that cashola while it still spends.
But you are less inclined to shop at Costco with this new policy, yes or no?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. Yes, we have not gone into Costco to make a purchase, and we have purchased things online, mostly for the convenience and the prices and some goods that are only available at Costco. However, since that now infamous, at least to me and you, press conference, I am less inclined to purchase from them, just on a matter of principle, but they're not going to give a shit.
I have a thought experiment follow-up question to that.
All right. See, we're talking about Costco instead of the Patriots. So this is our episode tonight.
Your episode 131. Shop at Costco. I have some Kirkland pants that are like outstanding. And they're like pre-made Indian foods, really good too. So just to stay on this topic for a moment, let's say that the marching orders for masks came down from a private scientific entity of some sort. It wasn't some sort of mass propaganda campaign as we're seeing currently. Would that, and then based on that private advice from a private scientific institution, Costco decided to follow suit and require that on their private premises. Like, is that more, I would assume, is that more acceptable to your principals, or is it strictly the demeaning nature of the whole situation?
If you're directing it at me, then yes, I think that if the incentive structure, wittingly or not, was a private, and they were actually following the scientific evidence, which it doesn't seem like they actually are right now, because there are plenty of medical professionals and industry, you know, websites and whatnot that are saying, you know, this is actually not beneficial. This is not scientifically sound. The studies are not indicating that this is helpful at all. And in fact, there are certain risks involved with this, and no one is taking any of that into account. But if there was a more of a free market in the analysis, and also the presentation is more neutral and not so biased as what we're getting today, then yeah, I'd probably be more inclined to take that information more on its face than I do now. But I still think it comes down to the individual's risk profile or risk tolerance on a subjective level. And Bob Wenzel of Target Liberty and Economic Policy Journal has a really good 15-minute little podcast episode that's talking about this, as well as what is kind of driving the hysterics and the emotion and the fear. And so I'll post that on our show notes page, because I think it's super important, though not really related to the Patriot itself. It is related to liberty, which this movie is depicting, a struggle for liberty. And one of my favorite things, my wife has a friend who's fairly left-leaning, and they engage in conversation a fair amount. And she literally asks my wife, "What freedoms do you feel like you've lost? I'm curious. I really want to know." This is an honest
point to anyone. I mean, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So, you know, and then
the
you
real
get pointed
head scratcher.
Yeah. So anyway, unfortunately, you know, people go along with what they see in the mainstream media, even though they are demonstrably wrong so often, so many times, biased all up and down, saying completely opposite things, even on the same day. It's just ridiculous how they still have any credibility at all, and people still buy into it. So it's
there's a fair amount, I think, of the corporate heads and whatnot. There's a lot of pandering that happens. They pander to the left a lot. You see all these like Black Lives Matter commercials, all kinds of stuff. Coronavirus this, coronavirus that, whatever the social cause of the day. You see all kinds of corporate backing. So I don't know if this is a pandering move by Costco, or if this is a true believer move by Costco. At least they are paying the market price by excluding people that are mask averse to actually shopping in their stores. So I do appreciate that, but it seems that gives me some sense that they're more true believers, but I don't know. What do you think, Bobby?
Well, can I interject for just a moment? I think they crossed the line when they said, "We advocate that this policy be mandated statewide due to the governor's executive action." That's where it crossed the line for me. It went from their property.
Right.
Because like you were saying, I think there is like a cost benefit analysis there where people will have a private business and be like, okay, well, it sucks, or it is what it is. You can think what you want about it, but the vast majority of the population is listening to what the state institutions are telling them in regards to this, and it will affect our business if we don't follow suit and on some level advocate, if not fully enforce this. So,
right. And it's also
we're okay. So,
and it's also like an example of, if they're already doing it, then it's costless for them to force their competitors to also do it now. So true. In a way, it's a protectionist move,
right,
to have the state enforce what they're already doing themselves.
Much like when they raise their own internal corporate minimum wage and then they enforce that on everybody else through the state.
Right, right. Or yeah, you see like a Walmart advocating for higher minimum wage because they can absorb it. Meanwhile, mom and pop or lesser profitable corporations cannot compete with that. But let's talk about the Patriots, shall we?
All right.
I have an angle. This is that Tavendish character and why he's so eager to prove himself, to make a name for himself. And he tells this to Cornwallis, that the reason that he's trying to do this is because his name is disgraced in England. His father had done something that had brought shame to them. He'd lost their property, their title, their whatever. And so he's gung-ho to somehow make a name for himself by being very aggressive, very brutal, very loud about accomplishments and getting in the good graces of those who can bestow things upon him, accolades, property, because Cornwallis is talking about getting, you know, 100,000 acres of Ohio or something like that and carving some of it up for him. And so I think that is a driver for him to prove himself. And I think in another context, it would be like really good if it's in a private way, in an entrepreneurial way. It would have driven him to be, you know, a very effective, single-minded, you know, driven person to come up with a solution to problems for people to provide value. Whereas since he's, you know, attached to the state in a military aspect, it's used for evil. And he does atrocities, war crimes, to exert his brutality to try to get the prize that's being offered. And you notice when he offers this to Cornwallis, he waves away his aid. So there's no witness to him coming to this agreement to do ungentlemanly, illegal warfare against innocent women and children and civilians, because he wants it done because the Mel Gibson character is a thorn in his side. And because he's not following the standard procedures for war, it's really hard to, you know,
he's got his dogs.
Yeah. And he's got his dogs too. And they like him more than Cornwallis. Yep. They like Mel more. So he's willing to do these illegal things and come to this agreement to deal with a problem that is also not following the rules, even though the rules are kind of bullshit. I think, you know, in a warfare situation, guerrilla tactics, especially when you're far outgunned and outnumbered, are kind of called for. I mean, if they're literally there trying to kill you, you can't just stand in front of them and you know, exchange fire, right? Which is the mistake that he saw looking out the window.
I think that was one of the mistakes. I don't know exactly what tactics he was disagreeing with in that scenario, but I think he did see a superior force fighting an inferior force, and the inferior force looked to be trying to match them shot for shot, which, yeah, would be a mistake.
Right. Now, what do you think of this idea of this character who's been shamed trying to bring glory back to his family name and utilizing these brutal tactics to do so? Do you kind of see that angle?
Yeah, I see that angle. And I think he's right. The evil character here, he would probably return back if he got the land in America and he wanted to like sell it off or whatever, or retire in America and be some kind of a landlord type person. He would probably do well, or he could go back to England and be seen as some sort of conquering hero type person. I mean, the war propaganda efforts tend to really gloss over the horrors and atrocities committed by your side and then really amplify up the horrors and atrocities committed by the enemies. So yep. I think he was probably one of, I think people like him were more common than are depicted in this film.
Yeah.
Very steely-eyed pragmatists that are just there to get a job done and really don't see the difference between shooting a guy when he's down and waving his hand stop and like 2 seconds earlier when he was aiming a gun at him. He's just like, whatever, it's the same person, I'm going to kill him.
Right. Yeah. And that's when they shot all the wounded and burned the house down. No prisoners, no surrender. And you brought up an interesting point because, yeah, that's exactly how the Mel Gibson character was viewed as a hero by his people, even though he had shame for how he had handled that, and people didn't know the truth about it. So whenever people would be proud of him, he would feel shame for it. So, but yeah, it's a very challenging situation to be in, I think.
Yeah. So I got one more scene. If you guys got no other scenes or whatever you guys want to talk about, but I got one more scene we could talk about.
Okay. I can do that. And I know Bobby will have something.
I'm sure Bobby's sure. Going to have some stuff. So, the Mel Gibson rounds up a bunch of militiamen and they are carrying out these raids and they're hitting these supply lines and killing all these redcoats. And then they have a situation where a bunch of redcoats are going to surrender and then they shoot them right in the face or whatever. And they're just like, 2 seconds ago, you were trying to kill me. So whatever. But the Heath Ledger man, young Joker boy, is like, hey, this isn't who we are. This isn't, we're better than this. What are you doing? And at that point, Mel Gibson says, yeah, you're right. From now on, we're gonna accept surrenders. And we're not going to kill people if they surrender. And you have to follow my rule. And they're like, what are you talking about? You have to follow a rule. This isn't the army. And he's like, yeah, this isn't the army, but this is like my militia or whatever. And so he says to this quote right here, you're free to come and go as you please. But while you're here, you must obey me or I will shoot you. And I don't know, as a voluntarist, I don't know how I feel about that. You're free to come and go as you please, but as long as you choose to be here, you got to do what I say, or I can just kill you.
Why not just let him leave, like he initially insinuated at the beginning of that quote?
Well, they can leave, and that's still part of the deal. But if they disobey him by, say, shooting prisoners, because he's now said right. We're no longer shooting prisoners, then he's letting you know what the sentence will be and how it will be carried out.
But not just for that, though. Not just for shooting prisoners, but anything, he says. He's trying to be some sort of a military officer where you are conscripted and you will face death if you try and go against your orders.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a little bit of
thing there.
I'm sure there's a little bit of leeway, like, oh, hey, I need you to peel these, 800 pounds of potatoes. No, I won't do that. I'm going to shoot you. No, it's probably going to, have a little bit of gradual,
hyperbole, but yeah.
So were you with Mel Gibson in this situation? You think this is a perfectly reasonable thing to say?
Yeah, I think if he says, hey, you're free to go, or if you stay, here are the conditions. And if you don't, follow through on those conditions, then this is going to be what happens to you in the most severe case. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
That's a perfectly reasonable voluntarist type organizational method.
In a military engagement, yeah, it kind of seems that way.
What about in just like daily life?
Well,
just like hanging out with your buddies.
The stakes are a little different.
You're going to drink this beer or I will shoot you in the face.
Yeah, I think the context will matter. I know it's 2020 and context doesn't matter anymore, but I'm going to say context matters here.
You racist.
That is racist.
All right. So I just want to throw a shout out to my man, Murray N. Rothbard. He wrote a 4-volume set called Conceived in Liberty, and he had handwritten a 5th volume, and a guy, I believe Patrick Newman from the Mises Institute, due to some work with Murray Rothbard's notes, was able to decipher what was written on the parchment. And apparently he had like chicken scratch doctor prescription style handwriting, but he got so good at it in translating the Progressive Era book that came out just a few years ago that a 5th volume that now completes the set of Conceived in Liberty that covers the colonial period all the way up through this American Revolution, which is depicted in the film, or at least portions of, is now available. So just throw that shout out there. It's available on Amazon.com. So I'll have a link to that on the show notes page at lastnarrows.com/131. So Bobby, over to you.
How much time do we have?
All the time in the world.
Okay, I just have some kind of general philosophical questions for you guys in regards to the overall sentiment of the Revolutionary War and celebrating 4th of July and things of that nature. So I find that as a voluntarist type perspective, in this conversation has kind of shed some light on trying to hammer this down. But as far as celebrating the 4th of July today, with people like us, like, is it, you always hear the cliches of like the whole, like, you know, oh, the, oh, what is it? The magic sky cloth and things like that. Is celebrating this holiday a purely statist phenomenon, or, I mean, is it permissible for like a hardcore ANCAP to celebrate while still remaining consistent with their tenets and ideologies?
Wow. I think my answer for that would have shifted back and forth several times over the past several years. And I'm not even sure where I stand right now. I could tell you that for the last several years, I've seen other people celebrating freedom due to Independence Day. who have no conception of what it would even mean or stand for.
It's ritual.
Yeah. And even more so this year than any year prior. But you know, that volume that I was just talking about, by Rothbard, he basically analyzes, like we do for movies, from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective, that period of history. And he argues that it's basically libertarian in thought and philosophy, and it's actually a burgeoning of additional freedom as compared to or relative to previous. And it was like a grand experiment to try to actually gain some liberty for the individual versus the collective. Now, it hasn't borne out in history. It's actually, like we talked about earlier, it's grown the state even bigger and bigger. And now Hoppe has, in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed, basically broken down how democracy or a democratic institutional type government, like similar to what we have now, republicanism form, whatever, but that the incentives are such that a monarchy would actually have more incentive to treat the land and the populace better than in a electoral process. And he's not advocating for a monarchy, and that's where a lot of people get confused. He's just comparing two systems and saying this one incentivizes this, this one incentivizes this other thing, and it nets out that one is probably going to perform better than the other. So in that regard, I think that I'm not sure where I land on this. Like, I can appreciate the attempt at growing freedom and the sovereignty of the individual, but I can also see that it hasn't borne out to it, and that most people sort of like just follow the motions of celebrating this just to blow shit up,
right,
and have a barbecue.
I also acknowledge, like, a lot of the themes of this time, whether it be aside from the irony of the mass populace voluntarily voting their rights away while simultaneously celebrating theoretically freedom on the 4th of July once a year, you also have to acknowledge a lot of the themes of these ideas are exploited for euphemisms by the state. And I'm sure we could go off on a tangent, but I'm thinking specifically of, like, you know, wartime euphemisms like the Patriot Act or Operation Iraqi Freedom. I believe Reagan even referred to the Mujahideen as freedom fighters at one point, spreading Jeffersonian democracy to the Middle East, things of that nature. So I think that it kind of gets lost. It gets the water gets muddied with this kind of stuff. And it's one of those, like, please celebrate responsibly kind of things. So I guess I would ask, and I want to hear Robert's answer to that initial question as well. Is it consistent, ideologically consistent, to celebrate the 4th of July as a anarcho-capitalist?
Well, I think that's it. Okay. Here's my answer. Well, first of all, I'm looking forward to the Babylon Bee articles for the 4th. I think they're going to be good this year. I would say that since the 4th of July is a concept, and it's also an event, but it's a concept that exists in each and every person's mind, and it really depends on the spirit in which you are celebrating it. So I think I could celebrate it perfectly aligned with my principles as a symbol of freedom, but, you know, 99% of the world is going to disagree and think it means something completely different.
Right.
And then there are, in the terms of it being an event that draws a lot of attention, that there are going to be different people that are going to use the scene and the event to co-opt it and, you know, use it for their own political means. And so the state's going to use it to drum up all kinds of patriotism. Any kind of activist group is going to talk about how it's probably racist. Mm-hmm. There are any number of people that'll use it to twist it and get just to get their eyeballs on them to talk about what they care about. So, can an anarcho-capitalist voluntarist really celebrate it unironically? I think you can, but you have to understand or have to recognize that there is no pure voluntarist holiday. It's the spirit in which you celebrate it and the ideals of, even as flawed as they were when they were actually created July 4th. I mean, we're all for secession, right? And as flawed as it was, it was still a secessionary movement, and we got to cheer for that, I think.
Interesting.
All right, very safe answer, very pussy, Robert.
Was it though, Daniel? A little fence city, was it?
Yeah, just quoting High Fidelity.
Very pussy. Yeah, it's telling that line between, I would argue, I think you could make the argument that libertarianism is a form of true patriotism in the superficial sense, not getting into the granular parts of it. But there is that fine line between nationalism and patriotism, depending on who you ask, I think. So one last question to both of you. I don't mean to steer the ship here, but a simpler version of what I just asked is, are you guys this year on Saturday going to be celebrating the 4th of July?
I probably will not. I've never been a person. And in the past, I've been to 4th of July celebrations where people like get out all the state paraphernalia with the flags and then the napkins that are flags, and you got little sparklers that are red, white, and blue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a younger person, I was just like, yeah, the U.S. is like a colonialist empire, blah, 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 blah. I don't like it. And these days I'm like, yeah, statism. But at the same time, I've even heard of, you know, normies saying, hey, 4th of July, the original Brexit. And I'm like, hey, that's pretty cool.
That's a start.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, we're not really celebrating the Independence Day per se. It's one of my daughter's birthdays right before then. And so we're going to have family over for that. And they're going to stay for a few days. And then our neighbor, he's a good dude, but he's a bit on the normie angle. Our normie edge of things. And he just likes to blow shit up. America, fuck yeah. So there's going to be a fireworks display across the street. And we'll stay up late with the kids and be able to watch it.
You can't sit in your house with your arms crossed and just like, I'm not watching fireworks because my principles. You know.
Yeah, I mean, we are curmudgeon-y old men, but.
You guys are like the two dudes on the Muppet Show.
That's exactly.
We actually had that for our branding at some point. We were working on that.
Nice.
Yeah, so. This has been an all over the place discussion. I think we talked about the movie a little bit, but we should probably do what we call final summary and review. And Robert, if you'd like to model that for our guest, Bobby, and you can choose whichever style of rating system you
want to use. Daniel?
Points. It could be stars. It could be fireworks. It could be flag colors, whatever you want to do.
American flags out of 10.
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah. Okay, so the Patriot. You know, I hate the Patriots, the football team. Never been a fan. Probably for the statism connotations and the fact that they're the evil empire and they win all the time. Now with Brady gone, I don't know, but Belichick's still a bastard. The best, probably the best coach you ever. But you know, you can still love to hate the guy. But this movie with good old what's his name, Mad Max.
Australian guy?
Yeah, the Australian dude that was the American Patriot in South Carolina. He, you know, I, why was he a bad, that their opening scene just bugs me. He's like this terrible carpenter. He's making a chair. And then for the only reason to have it referenced later when he's in Cornwallis's house and he sees, oh, Cornwallis has a nice chair. Well, what was the point of that at all in the movie? There's just made no sense to me.
That's American ingenuity. He was trying to make it lighter. He was weighing it to get it down to be like 11 ounces, but still support his weight.
The comic relief in this film is very shoehorned and half-assed, if I may say, and that was a prime example of that.
Yeah, right. That was a comedy scene.
Exactly.
well, we're both right, but it's also...
It's funny because he broke the chair in the beginning of the movie, and then he sat on a better one.
And he sat on a better one later. Comedy.
It's gold, Jerry.
It's definitely gold. But okay, so the story itself is a pretty good revenge story, I guess. It's a little bit, they try and weave all kinds of things together. It's very an ambitious story, I'll say, that they've got, you know, the slave that still wants to be there and fight in the army despite the fact that he's been set free. You got the romance story between the son and the, I don't know, the constables or the, no, what was he? He had some kind of a store, newspaper guy. I don't know. And then you got the romance between Mel Gibson and the sister-in-law. And then you got the evil British attacking, but then you got the noble general guy who wants to follow the conduct of gentlemanly war where the peasants all die and the officers are all gentlemen and they don't get shot at. That's, you know, I appreciated that when Gibson was like, yeah, well, maybe if your officers don't act like assholes, then we won't shoot at them too much. That was kind of cute. So, yeah, the acting was nothing particularly good. I think this movie kind of gotten forgotten. It's not remembered as one of the great Mel Gibson movies or even one of the great, you know, 90s or 2000s movies. It kind of got lost in the shuffle. It's because it's just kind of average. It's just kind of like effective for the most part. It's nothing super memorable. But it's a decent revenge story. This is back before when Heath Ledger, back before his full powers. So he's just like this young, you know, handsome, energetic kid guy. He's not like super master actor Joker guy yet. Overall, I'd have to say that this is, I'd say it's about six Betsy Ross flags out of 10. It's competent. John Williams' score really helps it. But the directing is like, I don't know, average at best.
Yeah. Do you think that maybe we should have done his other film, Independence Day, about the aliens and Welcome to Earth? Would have been.
Well, it definitely has a more charismatic lead in that film. That's for sure. Maybe we can all get behind
Bill Pullman,
an alien invasion going back. And I know you really still like that president speech.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This will be our Independence Day.
I was reading online.
They're setting us up for the fake invasion that they're gonna fake.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading lately. Is the whole Project Bluebeam thing is next after the orchestrated race war and coronavirus. So stay vigilant.
Looking forward to it. Is that gonna be in 2021 or 22 or do we know?
It's happening this weekend. Is what I've read, but who knows?
The odometer's got to kick over to July because every month has to have a theme.
Right.
So
they were hiding in plain sight with Independence Day. They were letting us know because that literally happens from like July 2nd through July 4th. That whole movie.
It's going to play out. All right. So Bobby, yeah, you've seen it demonstrated as seen on TV by Robert here. So take it away with your final summary review and whatever scoring method you, you choose, just give us a reference to what it is out of or related to. So we get an idea of if it's good, bad, and somewhere in the middle.
Sure. And I will just say this. It's certainly not flawless. I think we can all agree on that. For me personally, it was nice. Like, I'm so in the world of watching weird movies or obscure movies or art house movies. That's kind of my regular rotation. Not to sound pretentious, but that's just how it is. And I haven't sat down and just watched a, like, turn your brain off, like, rah-rah America propaganda film like this. And it's entertaining enough, and even though it is at 2 hours and like 20 minutes or whatever it is, it moves relatively fast, I thought. It does have some pros as far as, I know we were complaining about the character's arc at the beginning where Mel Gibson, like, he's like, I don't want war, and then he's like, all right, let's go to war, like within like 15 minutes. I think, and I don't know if this was an intentional, profound statement in the storytelling, but I think that the real arc of this character, again, to its credit, is the perception of his mythology by his adversaries. And what I mean by that is they always refer to him as the ghost. Like, he's this lurking revolutionary militia leader. And that's... the arc is almost outside of who the person actually is. And again, I'm probably reading way more into it than I should. That said, Roland Emmerich mixed with Mel Gibson, who Mel Gibson is notorious for having pretty controversial films. This movie wasn't well received by, say, the British, much like Braveheart or the way the Jewish community received Passion of the Christ. All Mel Gibson. He knows his audience. He knows what he's doing. And I think the same argument could be made with Roland Emmerich. They're both very good at what they do. And again, I agree with Robert. It's not a memorable film, and this doesn't say much about it. But for a role, I would say that it is Roland Emmerich's best movie. To be fair, he did Godzilla and 10,000 BC and some other pretty bad schlock, and not in a good way. Like, Independence Day is probably his most recognizable film, but that movie did not age well at all. And to this movie's credit, I feel like it's schmaltzy, but it wasn't groan-inducing. And for a big budget, early 2000s, general public movie, that is quite an accomplishment. So if we're going, I'm going to go stars on Betsy Ross's flag. Okay. Can I do that?
So out of 13, then?
Out of 13.
We're going to get complicated here.
Out of 13, I'm going to give it a eight stars out of 13, which basically converts to the same rating that Robert gave it in number of Betsy Ross flags. If you deduce the fraction or whatever it is.
All right. So I guess I'm going to have to give it a number of stripes rating, perhaps. That might be the direction I need to go. So we'll just have a shared moment on the Betsy Ross flag. Well, I agree with both of you guys. This is a bit of a middling movie, though, because it's shot as a period piece. You know, it's an older film, or depicted in, you know, revolutionary times, and the costuming and everything looks pretty good. The story is not like super great or memorable, but I think it holds up better than Independence Day or a lot of other films. And I think that you could watch this, 10 years from now and still get the same level of mediocrity out of it. maybe a little bit higher than that. I mean, it's not like it's a terrible film, but it's not like super great. So, I mean, Mel Gibson, he's fine. He's competent. Heath Ledger's pretty good. I did like just how evil and dastardly they made the British out to be in this film. And Bobby, you sent me a YouTube video that talks about just how ridiculous and how outsized they made the evilness be. So I'll post that on our show notes page as well, because it is pretty ridiculous, especially when they talk about the church scene where they put the whole townspeople in there and burn it down with the people inside. And they make the point like, well, if that actually happened, you'd probably still hear about it. You know, that would be like a pretty big atrocity that would be, you know, memorable and brought up all the time. But just in general, I think it's a good movie, and it's appropriate for this time of year, even though in this particular year, we're not really saying give us liberty. We're saying give us liberty or give us mandates, which we will blindly follow, which is apparently true for 99% of the population.
Vaccines.
Yes. But out of the stripes that you see behind me here, it's a little bit of a tattered flag. So I'm going to say we make it up to, maybe that seventh bar out of 13. So just above middle of the road for me on my rating for this one. On episode 131 of the show, find the show notes more at lastnightofdotcom/131. And any feedback from you guys before we get into the thanking of our sponsors? I'll start rolling the Patreon names down below here on the YouTube video. By the way, subscribe on YouTube if you can. As long as we're still on there, more subscribers helps us out. I'm sure, as Bobby, you said earlier, we're probably going to get shut down pretty quickly here. I've already lost one channel before, so why not make it two or three?
Yeah, why not go for the whole full-on hat trick, Daniel? Knock it all out. But usually, I think you have to get to a certain level. But I mean, if we do ever get noticed, I think, yeah, our views would be depersonable, unpersonable,
deplatformable.
Problematic, Daniel.
Yes, triggering. All right. Well, not sure what else to say other than next week, we're going to get Classy San Diego with our good friend Pete Quinones, also known as Mance Rayder of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, as we review the Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman classic Casablanca before it gets deplatformed for depicting racial overtones and things of that nature. So that should be a lot of fun. I threw a little bit of a fake out there. It sounded like we're going to do Ron Burgundy, didn't it?
Well, no. I mean, Kevin Costner is not in Casablanca. So what? What do we, I don't understand.
Right. Yeah. With Pete Mance, we call him Mance still. We mostly do Kevin Costner.
Only do.
Right. And I approached him about doing The Postman later this year, and he's down with that. But he's like, well, I want to get on with you guys before then. And so we cleared his schedule in July. We cleared our schedule. His people talked to our people, and we settled on Casablanca.
Casablanca. Okay. Well, I guess it'll be a first time watching that thing.
It's a classic. You got to watch it.
Supposedly.
And it is actually quite good. So spoilers, everyone. It's a good movie. I'm going to give it a positive review.
In your hat already?
That's right.
You've seen it? You've seen it already?
Long ago.
Peter.
About 10 years ago, maybe 15, something like that. But anyway, that's going to be next week with Mance as our guest. And our guest this week was, of course, Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast. Final plug for our audience, Bobby. Tell people where they can find you.
Yeah, Not For Everyone podcast is everywhere you can find fine podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, all that jazz. And then, of course, I got to plug Death to Tyrants podcast. And then you can follow me on Twitter. I'm gonna announce my anonymous Twitter handle on here. Liber T. Nelson, as in Craig T. Nelson, but Liber T. Nelson is my Twitter handle. If anyone, I follow back. But yeah, Not For Everyone podcast, not political, but it's a fun lowbrow time with a couple of dudes. So I guess that's my plug.
All right. That sounds like fun. Sounds like an ad in the back of a magazine. So
thank you. I write copy for a living.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you, Bobby. And I hope that you can stick around for a little bit longer for our bonus content that we have for our Patreon supporters. So everyone check it out. LastNighters.com/Patreon. Show notes and more on this episode on the Patriot. LastNighters.com/131. You can also find it on Launchpad Media at thelaunchpadmedia.com. And with that, we'll say happy Independence Day and good night from last night.
Woo!
All right, we're going to continue the transmission on the Actual Anarchy portion for just a hair longer. And sort of talking about some of the things that we were mentioning earlier, guys, is due to the now realization, due to the coronavirus, and now also the, what we call the race war, it really seems like we are far more outnumbered than I had ever thought before. And I had sort of lamented on a couple of episodes back when it was just the pandemic. And then I sort of recovered from that a little bit and started feeling a little bit better because people seemed to maybe see through it a little bit at the time, but now they've piled on even more. And now they're shifting it back into, oh, the spiking of cases and whatnot. So let's just say I've got the red, white, and blues a little bit as far as the prospects for liberty as we approach this Independence Day. So I ask you gentlemen, do you have any suggestions or advice or glimmers of hope that you see that can turn this frown upside down going into the coming near future here?
Well, freedom still celebrated in media, not necessarily the news media, but they still make movies about it. And it's still an audience pleasing thing. So, I mean, even if people don't know what it means, they still pay lip service to it. I guess I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, I want good things, Robert. Come on. Maybe we'll try Bobby here.
Just generally speaking, I think that we're at a new tier of
Bernie
people starting to question more things, people starting to see through the mainstream media. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but I feel like everything that's been going on, I feel like a lot more people are skeptical of things and they're almost playing all their hands, our fearless elites. And it's getting people thinking a bit more and reaching out to more alternative news sources or alternative ideologies like this one. And I hope I'm not wrong here, because I'm of the philosophy of start at skepticism and work from there. And it hasn't steered me wrong very often as far as what I'm seeing on CNN or MSNBC or even Fox News at times. So I feel like people are starting to be a little more awake, I guess.
And yeah, I'd say
some conversations going.
I'd say as the left gets more and more progressive,
mm-hmm.
and you get more and more factionalizing going on. Like you got these super progressives that were super progressive 10 years ago, but now they're almost like conservatives now because right. It's just accelerating so much. So you got people that were super on board with the left train 10 years ago. Now they're going to be called racists and bigots and everything else by, you know, mainstream media and being kicked off platforms and whatever. And they're like, wait a minute, I'm not a racist bigot. And then, so then, I mean, I think as you get rejected by the mainstream leftist progressive culture and you go, well, if they can demonize me, maybe they're demonizing all these other people that I thought were bad. And so maybe, yeah, they would be more curious to hear other points of view of people that were they once thought were persona non grata.
Well, I want to believe in that is going to happen, but with all the deplatforming and the seeming growing levels of acceptance of this progressive narrative being shoved down our throats, not only by the mainstream media, but also corporations, et cetera, it really feels like they're firing on all cylinders as far as clamping down with this police state control grid. To my little Alex Jones impersonation.
You didn't have to tell me that that's what that was.
Well, for the folks at home, you know.
For the folks at home. Yeah. You will eat leftist ass. I know.
I'm going to put that on the show notes too. That's such a good video. All right. Well, maybe some cause to celebrate. Maybe I just got to get through the funk a little bit. And Casablanca will probably help with that next week.
Well, are you seeing this even in your day-to-day life, like in your friends and neighbors? And when I know people on Facebook are one thing, but I mean, even just walking around the street, are people policing each other, telling each other to wear masks and whatever?
Well, I don't get out much. You know this.
I know you don't.
I'm a mountain man. I live up in the mountains and in the woods. But yeah, I mean, it's not just social media. It seems to be people that I actually know. Doing these virtue signaling things. And the sort of irony of it is the next thing they post will be totally contradictory. And they don't seem to notice.
Right.
Where, for example, at one point, everyone was like, use the police to enforce lockdowns. And then like literally 4 hours later, they're like, defund the police. And I'm like, ooh, that's getting interesting. But the irony there is very profound.
Well, and then they're right back, like they've almost forgotten the George Floyd. And then they're
so
right
did you guys
back
black out your profile, your profile picture?
I still did. Still blacked out. Yeah.
I've got Mises wearing a mask and a quote about those who wish for more government are demanding more more force and more squashing of liberty. Actually, you know, better that I just read the quote to you, right? Because then it would actually make sense. All right. It says, those who are asking for more government interference are asking ultimately for more compulsion and less freedom. There we go. Got to quote that guy right.
What a bigot.
Hate speech all up and down. That Jewish Austrian with all his hate speech. Anyway, this has been a lot of fun, Bobby. And we actually do have Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. And I do actually want to get your take on our take on Heat, if you know. Or let's just talk about Heat a little bit, because that was our previous episode. And I know you talked about it in one of your episodes recently.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie in about 15 years, but I can try to talk about it with you. It's a good
all
movie.
Right. Let's really sell this bonus content, all right?
Oh, man, it's going to be spicy.
Okay. It's going to be so good, all right? So hit us up at Patreon, and this is episode 188 of the show. Show notes and more, actualanarchy.com/188. You can find Bobby's links there for the Not For Everyone podcast. And Bobby, thank you so much for coming on. We'd love to have you back again. A couple of months out, we'll open up the calendar and find something to do another crossover episode.
All right.
So with that, we'll say maximum freedom, everyone, and peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.